Hello everyone and welcome back to Footprints, and this month we're going to go out and about on a folly hunt. Now, follies were a thing in the 18th and 19th centuries, or at least they were if you had cash to splash. The way to show off your wealth in those days was to build a temple, or a tower, or even a castle in your garden. The Folly Fellowship lists 1,700 follies in the UK on their website, of which 20 are in the Barscape area. As well as Midford Castle and Brown's Folly, there's Beckford's Tower, Sham Castle up on the skyline, and two or three follies in Prior Park Gardens. They are many and varied, and they are very hard to pin down into one convenient definition, but maybe we can persuade the editor of the Folly Fellowship magazine, Jonathan Holt. We'll also meet up with Fliss Swallow from the National Trust, who'll show me around the Prior Park follies. But we're going to start off up at Beckford's Tower, right up on the top of Lansdowne. And Bath residents will know that for some time now, the tower has been shrouded in scaffolding and plastic, while it underwent a huge renovation. Well, the tower and the museum open up again on February the 15th, and I went up there to meet up with Dr. Amy Frost, Senior Curator at the Bath Preservation Trust, to have a look around and to hear about the man himself who owned it, William Beckford.
Almost there.
Oh, and suddenly there are windows. Amy, how many steps was that?
From the front door to the top, there are 154.
And we've practically run up them.
I know, I probably made you go faster than we normally would.
And we'll just describe the room that we've climbed up into, Amy.
So this space, which is surrounded by windows, which has like a 360-degree view of the surrounding area, was called by Beckford, the Belvedere, which means beautiful view. And obviously what you get are a lot of towers that are called Belvedere, particularly, or Belvedere, so particularly in Italy, which is where the inspiration for these sort of towers in England came from.
To describe what we're looking at would be to describe the entire surroundings of Bath, wouldn't it? Because we can see down to the Mendips. Over here we're looking west, past Kelston Roundhill.
On a really clear day, to the west, you can see the Severn Bridge. And the thing that we always look for, which means we know it's a really clear day, is on the horizon towards the sort of south-east-south area. You can see Alfred's Tower at Stourhead.
And I bet you can see the White Horse on a good day.
Yeah, Westbury and Cheryl White Horses.
Before we come on to Beckford and who he was, because there's a lot of stories to tell around him, let's just investigate whether or not this is a folly. Because we think of Beckford's Tower as a folly, but what do you think? What do you think the definition is?
It's sort of, on one hand, really the absolute epitome of a folly. In that it was a building built on the whim of an individual, and an individual with immense power and privilege and a lot of money, and, you know, all this money created through his complicity in transatlantic slavery, and he just uses it to kind of build and create. So it becomes a building in a landscape that he doesn't live in. He lives down the road at Lansdowne Crescent. And so it's both a kind of folly in terms of a building in a landscape, but it's also his folly in terms of, like, the folly of man, you know, the kind of, like, the whim or the fool or the kind of person who just kind of spends and spends. And, you know, this one stayed up, whereas his previous one, Fonthill Abbey, that he built down in Wiltshire, was sort of an ultimate folly in that definition, because it, you know, then fell down. But then at the same time, it's sort of like, it depends on if you consider a folly to be something that has no function. I mean, all follies have a function. Their function is to sit in a landscape and be viewed and be a place that you can view that landscape from. But this building has more of a function than that. You know, this was Beckford's treasure chest. It's his cabinet of curiosities. It's where he kept his library. It's where he kept his all these kind of beautiful objects that the sort of brutality of slavery had paid for. And he would come up here every day and he would read and look at the view and write and move objects around. So I think for Beckford, in many ways, the best way to view a landscape but also feel like you were part of that landscape was from a tower.
So tell me a bit more about Beckford, because my understanding is that he didn't entertain here. Other people didn't come here. It was just for him.
So Beckford came to Bath in 1822, having sold his family estate at Fonthill in Wiltshire. And he was the third generation of a family who were hugely benefiting from, sorry, fourth generation of family that were hugely benefiting from the transatlantic trafficking of enslaved African people. So they had plantations on Jamaica, which made them an obscene amount of money. Beckford inherited when he was very young, when he was like 9 and a half. And he was, whereas his father was very involved with the business of slavery and, you know, went to Jamaica quite often, and Beckford was kind of groomed to be the gentleman, like the British aristocrat who owned a big estate, because the ownership of land at the time was still a symbol of power, even if power was increasingly in the hands of people who were in trade. So he never really got his hands dirty. And he used all that money, like so many in the 18th century British landowners, and always men mainly at this time, did on country estates. And, you know, they created landscapes and they built buildings in the landscape and they reformed their country house. And so Beckford had all of that in Wiltshire. And then he was massively in debt by the 1820s. And he came to Bath because Bath was a cheap place to live and still have a kind of veil of celebrity about you, or an idea of fashion, even though it wasn't really fashionable anymore. So he came here and bought a house at Lansdowne Crescent, and he rented or leased all of the land between Lansdowne Crescent and here and built this building at the top of it. And he would, you know, use it as his retreat, but it was also part of this idea of creating a truly picturesque landscape. And the picturesque is this movement that emerged in the 1790s, in particular in Britain, about architecture integrated into a landscape to create a view that looks like a landscape painting, looks like something by Salvador Rosa or by Claude, both artists that Beckford collected. And he's at the heart of that movement, like what he did at Fonthill and then what he did here is very influential in terms of that idea of aesthetics in not just landscape gardening, but in architecture and design in late 18th century. And in many ways, he sort of even goes beyond it, because he's really, really interested in everything looking as natural as possible. So this sort of like not wanting people to kind of see the hand of human creation, wanting to for it to feel like it's all natural. So he creates this designed landscape between here and down at Lansdowne Crescent that he would ride his horse up every day and then he would walk down. And it had a formal kitchen garden behind Lansdowne Crescent. It had open downs. He then planted the wood that's above Kingswood School. He brought in fully mature trees and created that wood. And beyond that, then, there was an old quarry, which is now Lansdowne Park, the development of houses. And he turned that into a really lush quarry garden. So lots of like ferns and rich kind of moist planting. And then you'd come out of that quarry garden through a small garden planted for very highly scented shrubs and plants. And then you'd go through a grotto, which we have just rediscovered and excavated. And then you would see the tower for the first time. So it's almost like there's this journey that you go through in order to then discover this building at the top. And the way that you would have been taken around the garden surrounding this building, surrounding the tower originally, there would have been lots of interlinking footpaths, and there was a fake kind of ruined archway. The idea being really that the tower itself would appear and then disappear again as you walked around. Playing with the idea of serendipity. And, you know, serendipity is a word that Horace Walpole created when talking about gardening. And it's the pleasant surprise. It's turning the corner in a garden and seeing a particular thing or a shrub. Or But more for Beckford, it was about the building almost appears like it's organically growing out of the landscape because it has all this planting around it. So you never really see the base of the building until you're on it, you're right in front of it. So it was really important to him, this idea of architecture being kind of integrated within that landscape and neither being dominant over the landscape nor being subservient to it. They've got this equal footing. And from a really young age, Beckford would go out into the landscape when he wanted comfort, when he wanted to escape, when he wanted to get away from his very overbearing mother. But he also writes about being in the landscape and having kind of almost like supernatural encounters with nymphs and dryads. And, you know, at the heart of the period when Romanticism is emerging, he writes a lot about the kind of impact of the natural world on human emotion. So he has all this real high kind of sensibility and a real affinity for nature and an understanding and appreciation of landscape.
A sense of but coming.
Yeah, there is a but. I mean, like with Beckford, with everything really, we have to balance that against knowing what gave him the money to do all of that, you know, to be able to go on a grand tour for 2.5 years and travel around Europe, to be able to collect all these really beautiful objects, to be able to create these landscapes, which are an expression of his ideas, is because of this extreme wealth that he got from claiming in ownership the lives of thousands of enslaved African people. And we have to balance those two things. And actually, we have to balance three things, really, because the other sort of very problematic side of Beckford's story is that he was involved in an abusive relationship with a very young William Courtney of Powderham Castle, which is the exposure of which is what drove Beckford into exile for 10 years in Europe. Not, you know, as we would today, because of the age of William Courtney, be horrified by, but because they were both male. So there are lots of these very problematic sides to Beckford. And we always sort of say to people, like, you don't have to like him. In fact, you probably shouldn't like him. But like with a lot of characters in history, you can be fascinated by them. And to try and unpick, you know, and I've read all these letters, and in one letter you read, and it's sort of so horrifying the kind of language he uses to dehumanise other people. And then you read another letter that he writes like the next day, in which he talks heartbreakingly about not being allowed to be in his home because of who he chooses to love. So it's such a balance between all these facets, and that's what makes someone interesting. And that's what we as historians can do. We can kind of unpick all of that and try and find ways of communicating these stories or telling these stories to other people, which is what we try and do here. This is a new public walkway that we've just put in as part of our just under £4 million project that we've just done that was supported by the National Lottery Heritage Fund. And we had this flat roof on the museum part of the tower, and we weren't really planning on putting anything other than solar panels on it. And then we went out one day and we were like, well, this is some of the best views. Why don't we see if we can put a walkway out here as well? So the museum rooms are sort of attached to the main tower. And this is the sort of flat roof of the museum where we've put in solar panels.
Now, there is another folly near here, isn't there?
Yeah, so in the grounds of Kingswood School, which was actually the grounds of a house called Summerhill, and in 1868, Summerhill was bought by Sir Robert Blaine, who later became MP for Bath. He was MP for Bath in the 1880s. And he bought Summerhill Park, or Summerhill House, and in, we think, around 1870, built this tower, the tower that's known as Blaine's Tower or Blaine's Folly in Kingswood School grounds. And the idea is that the possibility is that it was built by the Bath building firm Hicks and Isaac, or Isaac and Hicks, who we know did work for Robert Blaine in around 1870. So the kind of date that's been put on Blaine's Folly is about 1870. It had a room at the top of it, most of which is now gone. And it's a kind of slightly shorter but very close version of this one, of Beckford's Tower, which was sort of 40, 50 years earlier. And very much within the kind of style of towers that were being built in the mid-Victorian period, from the early 19th century and then into the mid-Victorian period, that are designed to look like Italian towers. That's what this one here at Beckford's Tower is. That's what Brown's Folly from the 1840s is designed to look like, and that's what Blaine's Tower or Blaine's Folly of the 1870s is to look like. And they're copies of, you know, this one, Beckford's Tower is first. So you kind of get this little fluttering of Bath copies that appear around the city.
So, Amy, Beckford's Tower's been wrapped in plastic for a long time in scaffolding. It's now beautifully restored, and I believe it fully opens pretty shortly.
Yeah, so we reopen on the 15th of February for the first time ever. We used to open kind of late March because the building got so cold inside and we had to take all the objects out of the museum. But we've put in air source heat pump heating, and like the museum temperature is absolutely beautiful and perfect for a museum. So we're actually opening earlier. So we open on the 15th of February through to mid-December. So weekends and Saturdays, Sundays, bank holiday Mondays.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for showing me around, taking me to the very top and back down to this lovely flat roof.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Thanks to Amy Frost there. Now, the Folly Fellowship is a charity set up to protect, preserve and promote Folly's grottos and garden buildings. Jonathan Holt is the editor of their magazine, and we met up at Sham Castle on a particularly cold winter's day. Jonathan, why are you interested in Follies? How did this happen?
Well, I suppose it started when I lived in Dorset, and I was taken by my father to see Horton Tower, also known as Sturt's Folly, which is an enormous tower made of red brick, which stands a few miles north of Wimborne, where I lived. And then I used to go off on cycle tours on my own, and then when I passed my driving test, I took friends in my car on folly hunts.
And we've come to Sham Castle, but before we talk about this particular folly, is there a way of defining what a folly is?
That's a very cruel question. As said Barbara Jones, who wrote the first book on the subject, and she went on to say, I wish you hadn't asked that question, because it's just not possible of easy definition. It's more easy to say what a folly is not rather than what it is. But generally speaking, it's usually some kind of decorative building which does have a use, contrary to popular belief. It doesn't have to be useless. There are, for example, banqueting houses, temples, game larders, bathing houses, boat houses, etc., which all have a folly-ish air.
But some are built just to look at, aren't they? They're just there, and they're within a sort of vista, and you can sit on a seat and look at them. Would you say that's true?
Certainly true of Ralph Allen's Sham Castle, because it can be seen from close to Pulteney Bridge in Bath. If you look up to the southeast, you can see it there. And it's what's called an eye catcher. Now, there's the theory that Ralph Allen built it to be seen from his townhouse in Lilliput Alley. But, in fact, that's been disproven because, in fact, there was already a building in the way. And by the time he built it, which was in 1762, in fact, he'd moved out. And, in fact, it faces more obviously towards London Road, the east part of Bath. So it wasn't built as an eye-catcher from his townhouse.
OK, so maybe it wasn't just about him then. He was building it for the people of Bath. But it was, is it fair to say, a bit of a craze at some point?
Well, by the 18th century, when Britain became rich from its colonies, all those crops like spices and tea and coffee being produced and I'm afraid to say, sugar being produced by slaves in the West Indies. And then the rich Brits had the money to build these follies, to decorate their grounds. And one definition is that it's a kind of mirror to a gentleman's mind. And you get an insight into some gentlemen, and it usually was men in those days, by the follies they build, their eccentricity, their perhaps curiosity, and their interest in other cultures such as Italy and Greece, because many of these follies were built in the Roman and Greek styles.
What's this one above us built in then? I mean, this is quite a large sort of facade of a castle, Roman castle, sort of Gothic.
Gothic castle, yes. It was common to build follies in the Gothic style. There was a trend in the 18th century to bring back what Horace Walpole called the true rust of the Barons' Wars, where landowners felt they had to give the impression that they'd been around a long time and they weren't just upstarts or nouveau riche who'd earned their money recently, which was the case of Ralph Allen. He had made a lot of money from the cross posts. In other words, those posts which didn't go to and from London, but across the country, say from Bristol to Birmingham or other cities. And then he discovered, in inverted commas, Bath Stone, and he marketed it very well. And he built Briar Park with it. And then he started to play around a bit and built this sham castle, which never defended anything. You see, the wars in England had finished by the end of the 17th century, so it didn't defend anything. It was just a pure fancy, just a decorative item.
Well, it's pretty magnificent, and we're glad it's here. What else have we got in Bath? I know we've got Brown's Folly, and also there's a grotto I've discovered in the Bath Spa Hotel. Tell me about those two.
Well, that was built probably sometime in the 19th century. It was General Augustus Andrews who came from serving in the army in India, and he built what was known then as, or what he called, Vellore House. And the grotto appeared there at some time, but we don't know when. It could well have been moved from Sydney Gardens, which used to have a grotto, among other follies and fancies. But then they drove the canal through, and then they drove the railway through. And so what happened to these various buildings, we don't know. And it's possible that some of the stone that you see in that grotto there comes from the grotto in Sydney Gardens, and it could well have been built by Josiah Lane, who was a well-known grotto builder in the late 18th century.
OK, so that's the grotto in the Bath Spa Hotel. What about Brown's Folly that everyone knows on the top of the hill, sort of that direction and pointing east?
Well, that's right. That was built by a certain Mr. Wade Brown, who lived at Monkton Farley. He was a quarry owner and made a lot of money from selling his stone. And he set up a school at which he taught in Monkton Farley. And he built that tower purely as an observation tower to look out over the Avon Valley. Later, it was sold to a certain Charles Hobhouse, who uses a kind of hunting stand at which to rest on his hunt around the countryside. And in fact, it's owned by the Folly Fellowship. We did it up. We put a new roof on it in 1999. But unfortunately, it does suffer from the predations of vandals and other disagreeable people in the wood that surrounds it.
What other follies could we see in and around Bath?
Well, you can look over a wall near Kingswood School where you can see Blaine's Folly, which was put up by Robert Stickney Blaine, who was a mayor of Bath around the 1850s, and later he became a MP for Bath for about a year, and he simply put it up for the amusement of his children. But after having been used by the senior boys of Kingswood School to go and have a smoke and a drink up there, now it's out of bounds, although you can see it over the wall near Kingswood School.
OK, well, go and have a look at that. You edit the magazine, Follies Fellowship. That's for the organisation. What else does the organisation do?
Well, it organises trips and talks and so on, trips to places of interest. For example, this year I organised a trip called The Height of Folly, literally, because in order to get up there, you had to go by cable car. Yes, this is at Matlock Bath in Derbyshire. Yes, so you can see the Victoria Tower up there. And then I took people around the various bar buildings and bathhouses of Derbyshire, which are well known. It's a great county for springs, and people decorate their wells, yes, with flowers and that sort of thing. And I give talks on follies to local history groups, and even early next year I'm giving one to the Somerset Vernacular Buildings Research Trust.
And we know that all the sort of stately homes of Britain have probably got a folly somewhere in them. Does this happen all over Europe and other parts of the world?
Oh, certainly. All over Europe, it's quite common. I visited follies in Spain, Italy, France, Germany, Belgium, the Netherlands, and so on, in several countries. And in Australia, I know somebody in the Folly Fellowship who's visited them there, and in New Zealand. In America, they have a haven't quite got it yet, the idea of follies. Because I know a man in Texas who had a hard time when he built follies in the grounds of his house, in his yard, in the state capital, Austin. And people would stand there and gawp and wonder, what the hell are you doing? And he was even fined by his neighbourhood committee for putting them up. So he moved out to a more rural location where he was able to carry on building follies at his own wish, you know, without interruption.
Didn't London Bridge get transported to the desert in the States?
Well, that's right. That would be considered as a folly because I don't think it crosses any water. Right. And no cars cross it anyway. So that idea of reconstruction, moving a building, for example, the Temple of Sulis Minerva in Sydney Gardens is a removal. It wasn't originally there. Originally, it was built to advertise Bath as a place to visit at a colonial exhibition towards the beginning of the 20th century. And then it got moved around a bit and then eventually ended up in Sydney Gardens. And there you can see it in all its glory.
And I just thought, Las Vegas, surely that's just one big folly, isn't it?
Well, I would just laugh if I went to Las Vegas because I know there's one place which has reproductions, usually in small scale, of various European buildings like the Eiffel Tower, the canals of Venice, the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and so on.
Well, thank you, Jonathan, so much for coming up to Sham Castle to meet me on a pretty cold, wintry day. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks to Jonathan Holt. And if you're keen to find out more about other follies in the area, details of their map and more information about the Folly Fellowship are in the show notes. Finally, now let's head over to see the follies in the National Trust's Prior Park Landscape Gardens. Fliss Swallow is the head gardener there, and I started by asking her why follies were important in a landscape garden.
Follies in a landscape garden were a really important part of the landscape garden itself. So different follies would have different reasons for being there. So for example, one of the follies that we're going to head up and see is the Sham Bridge. So lots of them were to create illusions and create focal points within the garden, which was a really important part of the landscape garden. So yeah, we've got a few different ones that we're going to look at, but they were a really important part of the landscape garden movement. And we've got some lovely ones here at Prior Park.
Well, now we're right at the top of the garden. We've got the chainsaws out today and the chipper going on quite near us, but we're right in front of Sham Bridge. Fliss, tell me about Sham Bridge.
The Sham Bridge is in the area of the garden that we call Pope's Wilderness. So calling it the wilderness is a bit of a red herring. It's actually sort of a bit more of the, not necessarily formal area of the garden, because the landscape garden movement was a move away from the formality of gardens that came before it, and really about bringing in the natural beauty of the place. So what Alexander Pope called the genius loci, so the genius of the place. Alexander Pope, the poet, was really influential in this the design of this part of the garden. So that includes the Serpentine Lake, which has at the end of it the Shem Bridge. So on the approach towards the Shem Bridge, you go along a winding path next to the Serpentine Lake. The Shem Bridge is sort of meant to look like a bridge over a winding river. So you're not, you can't ever see kind of both ends of the Serpentine Lake at the same time, which is part of the illusion, which was everything that a landscape garden is about. It's kind of that illusion and drawing people through the garden on this journey and playing with people's emotions with views and light and dark. So as you're moving along the Serpentine Lake, it's quite a light part of the garden, it's quite open, and you can see glimpses through the shrubbery on the left-hand side, down through the garden and across the cabinet, which is sort of more open area of the garden. As you get to the Shem Bridge itself, you move into sort of a darkened yew avenue, which is again this kind of play on the emotions of the visitor and this sense of awe and wonder at the natural world.
So yeah. This is like the Alton Towers, the pleasure gardens of the 18th century. Oh, I see what you mean. So coming along here, you think you're by a sort of beautiful river, and then you turn the corner and there's this sort of... How would you describe the architecture of that bridge?
So it's very much, all the architecture in the garden is very much of the Palladian style. So obviously the Palladian Bridge. So that was the style of architecture at the time. So that was Andrea Palladio. And yeah, the Shem Bridge was created in that style. So it's got these triangles, three triangles at the top, which also then are reflected in the roof of the college. A little bit of pruning to do to get that view again. But there is these repeated geometric patterns within all of the structures in the garden, which really ties it in together. And also the use of the stone that Ralph Allen used within the garden is also a huge part of these follies and the cohesive feel of the garden. And yeah, also mirrors the Palladian Bridge down at the bottom. So it's that feeling of it being more grand and kind of leading somewhere than it actually is. It's, you know, you can't actually use the Shem Bridge. It is just there for the illusion of it over the Serpentine Lake.
Oh, I see. We're entering a kind of yew wood, and here is the bridge. And you're right, it's just the front of it. There's no back, there's no water behind it. And then you come through this wood of yew trees out into, the most beautiful walk, which goes below Prior Park House, which is now a college. If you look up the hill, that's what you see. Magnificent house made of beautiful Bath stone. But if you turn left and look down the hill, there is Bath in the distance with Lansdowne, but then in the foreground there's the beautiful lakes and the Palladian Bridge. It's a very beautiful landscape, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's just the most beautiful view, and kind of that feeling of coming out of the sort of more closed yew corridor and coming out into this beautiful wide open view, you still get those same feelings that people at the time would have got. And I think that's the beauty and the sort of power of a landscape garden, is that you are still on the same journey that people would have had, you know, 200 years ago. I think that's one of the most amazing things about it.
And even looking across the city, I mean, I know a lot of those buildings wouldn't have been there, but the Royal Crescent you can see sort of glinting in the sun, can't you? That would have been built at this time out of the same stone.
Yeah, absolutely. And that kind of ties it in with the whole story of the garden and Ralph Allen and his influence in Bath, and particularly, you know, his connections with people like Alexander Pope. Really shows you how special this garden is.
Because it was his mines just up the road that dug out the first Bath stone. So what's your job on a daily basis? What does a normal day look like for you?
So we've got amazing groups of volunteers 3 times a week. So a lot of time is spent with them and kind of doing the actual practical tasks in the garden. Lots of planning, anything from kind of lots of seasonal things. So we've just finished our annual laurel prune, which is laurel was used a lot in 18th century landscape gardens. But it just means a lot of work, sort of autumn over winter, to kind of to prune those. And that is actually what you can hear of the chainsaws and the chipper doing at the moment. That's the last bit of our laurel pruning. So yeah, anything from kind of big jobs like that to footpath repairs, handrail installation.
Okay, where next then? Where's the next folly?
Yeah, so if we head down to the Gothic Temple would be a good place to head to, I reckon.
Let's go to the Gothic Temple. full of surprises, this garden, isn't it? Suddenly we're in a huge, round, flat, open space with another cascade coming down opposite us. Should we sit on one of these beautiful benches?
So, they're oak benches and they're inscribed with a line from Alexander Pope's poetry, which is about to consult in everything, to consult the genius of the place. So that kind of means within the landscape garden movement, that was about really taking the beauty of the natural situation of the garden and kind of working with that instead of sort of moving away from the sort of imposed formality of gardens previously to that.
And it was quite a different way of looking at gardening, wasn't it, from what came before? Just tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it absolutely was. So it was a real kind of move away from, things like parterres. So very formal sort of beds with flowers and kind of bedding plants and small clipped hedges and things like that. So it's a real move away from essentially kind of a sweeping away of that and kind of an appreciation of the natural landscape. And the main sort of focus for a landscape garden is to try and show off the natural beauty of the place whilst also guarding it. So it's that balance between keeping it looking really natural and wild but also having to do a lot of maintenance to kind of keep it looking like that.
So Fliss, tell me about this Gothic temple. All we can see at the moment is the foundations, literally, but tell me about that and why it was built.
Yeah, so the Gothic temple, it was a similar sort of structure in terms of what they were trying to do in the garden as the Shambridge. So it was built as a viewing place for people, visitors to the garden, to kind of look out over the pasture and down to the lakes and down to the bridge. But it was also, in a practical sense, to kind of offer a bit of shade to people who were wandering around the garden. And obviously called the Gothic temple, it was in the Gothic style of architecture. So it was very ornate, lots of scrolls and lots of ornate stonework. On the approach to the Gothic temple, you'd come towards the back of it. You'd then go into the temple and the views would expand out into this lovely open pasture and down to the views of Bath and the lakes and the bridge.
And we're going to walk down now to the Palladian Bridge and look at a couple more structures that might or might not be follies. So here we are below the beautiful Palladian Bridge, which we don't think is a folly because it's a structure that is used as a bridge. And we're going over another beautiful cascade into what must be the second or third lake.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a cascade over the bridge itself. So the Palladian Bridge is quite unique in that it's also a dam. So that is the first cascade over into the middle lake. And then the one that you can hear is the cascade that goes into the lower lake, which was restored in the last dams project, which finished in 2022, so really recently.
We're crossing over, looking back up the hill that we clambered up at the beginning. Up at the college, and we're coming to the sign which says Ice House.
So this area is the thatched cottage, which is right next to the ice house. So you can see sort of the back structure of the wall.
So who built the thatched cottage and what do we think that was used for?
So that was built, again, during Ralph Allen's, during the time that he was building and making the garden. So it would have had a roof, obviously given the name, thatched cottage. So we think it might have been a place for social gatherings, potentially parties. Landscape gardens were kind of used for that kind of thing.
Does that mean it's not a folly then, if it had a use? Well, I don't know, because the Gothic temple had a use in that it shaded people. It was somewhere to sit, somewhere to chat.
Yeah, it sort of crosses the line between it's used for a purpose, but whether that purpose is necessarily what you're sort of led to believe it is. So this would have looked like a cottage, this would have looked like somewhere, someone's home within the garden, that kind of pastoral landscape sort of within that. So obviously the Gothic temple had a purpose, but it wasn't necessarily what coming across a temple within a garden that you'd think it was for. So I don't know whether that's to do with it as well.
Well, I think that means it is a folly then. Let's call it a folly. Let's see if we can work out whether the ice house is a folly as well. And that's behind a rope. Oh, look at that. Oh, and you get a little echo looking in. So we're looking into a a domed sort of structure.
There is an entrance sort of round the other side, but not sort of totally accessible. But I'm told you can get in. I've never been in because I'm terrified of spiders. And there's loads of cave spiders in there, so it's not somewhere I'm keen to go in. But yeah, this is where Ralph Allen would have stored ice for parties, which would obviously have been this huge spectacle at that time.
Well, that makes sense, just behind the thatched cottage where people would have met to gather to eat and drink, to have an ice house behind. I don't think this is a folly. I think this is very, very structural. Yeah. It's got a big purpose.
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you on that. I think the purpose that it's for is what it was used for.
And also, I suppose it might not have been then, but it's completely hidden. You wouldn't know it was here unless you had brought me here, because it's tucked in at the side. It can't be a folly in that sense, because you wouldn't have seen it, would you?
Yeah, that's it. It wasn't this kind of focal point within the garden or kind of part of the garden journey. It feels quite functional.
Oh, Fliss, thank you so much for taking me around Pride Park Gardens, showing me the follies, talking to me about Alexander Pope and his influence on the garden and kind of things that people got up to and how the gardens themselves were used in those days.
I think it is amazing to kind of think about the fact that we do still get the same feeling when you look at the views, and really connects you to the history of the garden, that we do still walk around it and get the same feelings from it and the same kind of play on the emotions. And I think that's the real beauty of it. But yeah, it's been lovely walking around with you, Pommy. Thanks.
Thank you. Pride Park Gardens is open from February the 14th every day until November. Well, that's it for this episode of Footprints. Links to all the items in the episode are in the show notes as usual, and please do email us with any suggestions or comments at info@bathscape.co.uk. We would really love to hear from you. Don't forget, you can listen to all the previous episodes anytime you like, and please share as widely as you can with friends, family and colleagues. And for more information on Bathscape, visit the website bathscape.co.uk. Thanks too to the National Lottery Heritage Fund and players of the National Lottery for supporting our work. Footprints was hosted and produced by me, Pommy Harmer, and I'll see you next month.